Hi, today's April 17th, 2016. This is Mobile News Podcast number 156. I'm Todd Ogasawara. And my usual co-host, John Westfall, is not here today. And in fact, I was going to skip this podcast, except for one thing. The rumor is that tomorrow, from the point of view of this recording, April 18th, Google is supposed to finally release its Google Play Music podcast section, which they announced, I want to say, last September or October. I mean, it's been a long time. Podcasters have been able to submit their podcast to the service since fall of 2015, and I know I did. Mine is listed as live when I went to check it. So, anyway, I wanted to have a fresh podcast in case they actually do go live tomorrow, and I wanted it's something fresh and recent for Mobile View's podcast. So, although John is not available, I was able to corral a bunch of friends who've been here before in, let's see, is this alphabetical order? Okay, alphabetical order. Jack Cook, Sven Johansson, and Don Sorcellini. So we've got a podcast. Welcome, folks. Thanks for coming in such short notice. I literally called them up yesterday or Facebooked them yesterday saying, is anybody available to do a podcast? Can someone come and play, please? So thanks, guys, for coming on. Hey, so the first thing I wanted to ask is Sven in our email news group was talking about connecting an old school Ethernet cable to his Windows 10 phone. Wait, what do you call this thing, Sven? Is it a Windows Phone 10, Windows 10 phone, Windows 10 mobile phone? The branding just confuses the heck out of me.
Yeah, the branding's kind of screwed up. But it's a Windows, most people say Windows Phone with a little p.
Oh, okay.
The phone with a big p was an actual operating system. Mm-hmm. This is a phone that runs Windows 10 mobile.
Yeah.
So it's a Windows little p phone, but it's you know, the latest insider release, which is the preview builds, has added the drivers in it that I can use an Ethernet adapter, you know, an old USB Ethernet adapter phone, or from the dock that I can plug the phone into. So the dock's kind of nice. People heard about Continuum. You can plug the phone with one USB cable into this little dock, which can hook up to external video, keyboards, mice, hard drives, and now an Ethernet cable. So you almost have a whole little workstation there.
Whole little tiny PC.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and how old was this old USB Ethernet?
It's actually been around for a long time. It's a USB 2. It's a little linkless thing. I tried a different one. They said not all the drivers for everything are in. Well, this one happened to work.
So it's not even especially designed for use with this. It just happened to have the right chipset, right Ethernet chipset. Yeah.
One. It was also, it happened to work with my Windows RT device.
Yeah.
Which, you know, didn't work with a whole lot of them, but it worked with that. So
nice.
It was kind of a nice thing to have.
Windows RT, I haven't heard that in a while. I have one of those, by the way. But
yeah, I know.
So, Jack, I know you've been using Continuum too, haven't you?
Yes, yes. It's you know, I like it. It's not something that I'll probably use a lot, but yeah. I can't see if I was going to make a presentation.
Yeah.
This is what I would take. I would take my Windows Phone and my little dock, and it just works nice.
Yeah, you know, this isn't on our show notes, but just out of curiosity for Sven and Jack, and I don't know, Don, are you using Windows Mobile, Windows 10 phone, whatever it's called?
That thingy, yeah. I actually am using it, but I don't have a Continuum compatible device.
Oh, okay.
I have one of the Lumia 640s. So I haven't had the opportunity to actually try it out with Continuum. I've actually done some mirror casting to a couple of times the device to so that I could pass it to a PC and then show it up on a bigger screen. Uh-huh. But no good fun stuff that these guys get to enjoy. Yeah. By the way, Sven, I did congratulate you the other day, and I do want to make sure the audience knows incredibly impressed that you spent all that time and effort to make your completely mobile device incredibly immobile by tethering it with Ethernet. It's not many people would be able to actually pull that off, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, I've been doing that since Pocket PCs, and I had a compact flash Ethernet card that I had in
there. I still have mine.
Yep.
Yeah, and this is, of course, before we actually could do Wi-Fi easily in our pocket PCs. Yeah. Or, well, maybe that's not true. There, you could do Wi-Fi easily. It's just that there was no Wi-Fi to connect to easily back then.
That was my first thought was 2002 called, and they want their rig set sent back to them. You know, that was definitely how we did it back in the day.
Well, you know, so the question for Jack and Sven, since I haven't even seen a Windows mobile phone or Windows Phone 10 device in person. When you run PowerPoint presentations, as Jack was mentioning presentation, can it do all the transitions and stuff that, you know, you normally see in PowerPoint?
Yeah. I haven't found any I haven't used it a lot. Mm-hmm. I did see it last year at Summit, and that's why I wanted to buy the 950XL when it came out, so that I could do it. And I did make a presentation that I had created on my PC for a training, and it just everything came up, everything. Nice. So I mean, it worked really, really well. I was really, really pleased with it.
Nice.
Sven, how about you? Have you been using it at all?
It's not a function of Continuum. It's a function of the PowerPoint. But you can actually you can mirror cast your slides up to a big screen, and you get the speaker notes on your phone.
Oh, nice.
So you get your notes and the next slide and all that kind of stuff, right. And you get a pointer that you can use. So they really did a good job on that. You could take a little mirror cast dongle if you don't expect one somewhere.
Yeah.
But with the new phones, I can put a HDMI dongle on the bottom of the phone and plug it in HDMI without even that dock. It's a direct, you know. So you can actually do quite a bit with it.
So there's apparently, I think Don posted a link that said that there's a new Windows 10 mobile preview build, 14.3.22.
Yep.
Have you guys been playing with that? Any fun stuff?
Yeah, I actually have. And it's a great... The changes in the release are fantastic. A lot of it are supposed to be preview of what we'll see from the 10th, the Windows 10, the anniversary. It's been codenamed Redstone. And what we're supposed to see with regards to that when it goes regular release this summer. Great things, but a classic example, when you're in that insider's fast ring for all the pluses, there's been some minuses as well. There's been a lot of issues with applications opening, just some general bugginess. It comes with the territory. It's frustrating though, because this was when they announced what the changes were for this release, this build. I thought, wow, this is fantastic. I've been waiting to see a lot of this, and to have it just go to be able to look at that, but then not be able to do some of the basic functionality was a great example of when you're with these fast rings, when you're trying to push stuff out, you know, things like regression testing and the like sometimes take a back seat.
Yeah, so. But that's a known issue for fast ring releases.
Yeah, right? It is something to keep in mind. Yeah. It's once again that, and they always say it. I will say Microsoft says it above and beyond anybody else I've worked with, and I work with all the platforms for mobile on a daily basis. They're always big on when it comes to if it's beta, if it's fast ring, everything always comes with the caveat of you know what it is, what you're getting yourself into. Don't use it on production if you live and die by it.
Yeah, I don't know if you notice there's one, there's a lot of little bugs, but notice the FM radio is totally gone.
Oh.
I didn't get to that one yet. I've still been cursing at the other ones, and I'm doing that in alphabetical. I haven't gotten down to the Fs in the app list yet to get to the.
You'll skip right by because it's gone. It's not like it doesn't. Gone. But you can go to the store and get another one and it works fine. So it's not. So they didn't. The hardware, they just, we lost the app.
So do all the Windows Phone devices have a FM radio receiver?
The majority of them do.
Hmm. Yeah, I was going to say the majority do. I think some of the lower end, a couple of the lower end, but even that was a while ago, didn't come with FM. But I think even now, some of the 500 series, the later ones, have FM radio in them, if I recall correctly.
Yeah,
sure, with that giant new, Jack, for those who can't obviously see, Jack's holding up and we're seeing a video of him with his giant newbie phone that does all the fun, cool stuff. Thanks, Jack, for flaunting that.
Which phone is that, Jack?
I could hold mine up. show that it doesn't have that anymore.
This is the 950XL.
Okay, is that the one they call the City Man, or is that the Talk Man? It had some kind of code name.
Those were, you know, code names before they ever came out.
It's just a little bigger than the 950. I did it. The reason why I bought this one was because it was Microsoft hardware versus the 950 was the Nokia hardware.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, this is the first iteration with Microsoft actually making making their own. So that's why I did this.
Yeah, otherwise known as the pre-Surface phone.
Well, I hope that's the case.
All right, so that's Windows Mobile Insider's build 14.3.22. And there's on blogs at windows.com, there's a summary of it. What were some of the things you were looking forward to, Don, that may or may not be in there?
Some of the things, they did a lot of work around notifications that was really welcome. I'm one of those people that, you know, having worked with Android and having worked with iOS, I honestly, my favorite, the way notifications are handled on the Windows Phone platform, have always been kind of a favorite, but there was some room for improvement on how I'm able to customize and tweak. And now number of messages and how messages are grouped visually is a lot better in 14.3.22. Also, work around the Action Center, which for those who work with Windows 10 mobile, that area where, and actually you do get that on Windows 10 in general, the Action Center, where you get all your icons for quick access to functionality and toggle switches and things like that. It's very easy now to rearrange those. And I'm a big person when it comes to customizing the default settings for all those buttons in the notification, the action area, the notification center, they're typically the furthest thing from what I want. And now it's really easy. You can drag and drop and rearrange with those. So I found those two things just at the beginning were big. And those are there, and I have been able to work with them. Like I said, it's unfortunately, it appears the biggest problem that a lot of people, and for me, there's a couple of critical apps. A lot of the apps that aren't on the Universal Windows platform yet, they're, that will, for lack of a better term, we'll call them Windows 8.1 applications, aren't opening. They can't launch. And there's been some problems around that. Funny thing was, I decided to even go and try to uninstall and reinstall, and I found some problems in the store where things are getting stuck in the queue section for downloads. And so you can't re-download something. Even if you delete it, it's still there. It's kind of
queue. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been a little bit frustrating, but as we said, it comes with the territory. You know, when you're dealing with, you know, when you're dealing with FastRing, that this is going to happen. And it's nice to see the progress that's coming along and knowing that I'm sure there'll be another build fairly quickly that starts to address some of these things.
So the anniversary edition, Redstone, is supposed to, for both mobile and desktop/tablet, it's supposed to come out like around June, July, right?
They've been saying summertime. That's summertime. What I've heard.
Okay, so maybe August, September.
Yeah, you got plenty of latitude depending on which part of the country you're in.
Yeah,
I've got 2 feet of snow here, so I'm not sure when summer starts.
I was going to say, normally in the Northeast we call summertime August 5th through the 20th. That's about it. But it looks like this year, Sven, you guys have gotten our winter from last year. So.
Yeah, it's nice here, though, because I got, you know, we got almost a blizzard here yesterday, but today the streets almost completely dried off already.
Wow.
Goes away. It sublimates.
So where'd all the water go? Just downhill?
No, I guess it sublimates. It does not.
Oh, it sublimates. I see. Just poof.
Yeah. Just goes,
you know, solid to gas. There's no water between.
Yeah. That really messes up the entry-level chemistry students, but anyway.
Some of the things that Don was mentioning are actually posted on their blog post that those are known issues. Okay. So it's not like they're a real surprise. You know?
And again, it is FastRing. So
there's one that bugs me is I tried the dark theme because that's a new thing they have now. Yeah. And a lot of my settings pages are white text on a white background. So it's hard to tell what I'm doing.
So just so you're aware, Sven, if you look at that blog post, a couple of those are listed as known issues that have the word update in front of them.
Yeah.
That weren't there when I started. Yeah. Then they made it to update afterwards, and I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. The good news is about this is, and folks who've been around Microsoft long enough, no, they're really now, when it comes to this, they're really being as proactive as possible, but even reactive has been very fast as people are finding out things between using social media, and Gabe All has been great about that with social media and announcing things, and also the blog postings, the websites. They're communicating very quickly, you know, where we used to be in the dark at times for days, if not weeks or longer on some of these things. They've been good about it with the insiders builds.
Yeah, and speaking of Windows insiders builds, I've been in a slow ring for the Windows 10 tablet / PC side. But I so much wanted to see that Ubuntu Bash shell that I decided to switch to the fast ring yesterday, and it updated. You know, I didn't have to wait long for the update to start downloading, installed, and yay, and I go there, where's the Bash shell? Well, it turns out I have a 64-bit Dell Venue 8 Pro, but I have a 32-bit version of Windows 10 preview release on it. And guess what? Bash only works under 64-bit, which makes sense.
Yeah.
But any rate, I there is a way. I'm going to have to wipe my tablet and put a 64-bit on if it runs.
I think
it's and that tablet is still running well.
My Windows Venue 8 Pro, yeah.
It's
a great, you know, for $250 or whatever I paid for it, 64 gigs of internal, you know, RAM. It is an awfully good little machine. This is not your father's notebook, or even your netbook, I should say. The netbook sucked. The new Windows 8, and this was a Windows 8 device. The Windows 8 / 10 tablets and netbook-like devices are great.
I'll be honest with you. You're talking about the Dell Venue. I've actually got an HP Stream 7 running FastRing, because I really like to punish myself that way. But I've been really impressed, again, for a device that's sub $100 for a tablet.
Wow.
I've actually been – now, don't get me wrong. I'm you know, as soon as you go to the desktop or the Win32 versions of Office, it can start to bog down on you. But from a touch perspective, all the UWP, the Universal Windows Platform apps and everything, I use it on a daily basis for things, and I actually enjoy it. I've got that on a fast ring. I've got a separate notebook that I use for development. I've kept that kind of on the slow ring, only because I'm having to walk actually, it's on the preview ring. I stand collected, corrected, the new preview ring. I've kept it slow because I have to walk a fine line between being able to see the new features and being able to actually work with the, you know, things not breaking from a development standpoint, you know, because I use it for in conjunction with Visual Studio 2015. So,
yeah, there was a point I guess it was last October or so, where maybe it was even earlier than that. It was like in October 2014 when Windows 10 was still in beta, that I had 1 month I couldn't use my Venue 8 Pro because I had to figure out a way to get around the encryption that had suddenly turned on, and it wouldn't let me boot and log in. It was a lot of fun. But, you know, that's beta testing, right?
And so, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
there's an interesting app on that latest regular fast ring thing, and it's called Connect.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a Miracast receiver that runs as an app on your desktop or laptop. So I can Miracast from my Windows phone to that app on my laptop.
Mm.
I can tell that it's going to be available from laptop to laptop because I've had it work once or twice from a Venue 8 to a Surface. It doesn't work all the time, but it really tries. No, because what it does, it looks like a Miracast receiver on a TV where it says, you know, waiting to connect, and then it says you're about to connect with this device. You can see that happening on the PC, and then it just kind of dies sometimes, and occasionally I actually connect. But they don't say it does PC to PC yet. They're intended for my phone, and that works well.
Nice. Yeah, but to answer Jack's question again, for a $250 device, I'm shocked how well Windows 10 runs in that Venue 8 Pro. I really am. You're not going to edit the next great American movie, or you probably shouldn't do like raw video, raw photo processing on it. But it runs Word and all that. In fact, I think it came with Office 2013, not Office 365, but the standalone, and all that stuff works fine. No complaints.
No.
And I should also mention I had an Asus, a $200 Asus CloudBook running Windows 10 on loan from Asus. I'm sorry, Acer. Sorry, Acer. The Acer CloudBook was amazing. It had no touchscreen, but it was a 14-inch screen, which is great, right? I mean, that's something, and a full-size keyboard, something you can work with. So it's $200 Acer CloudBook. It was really, really fun to run.
The VenueAge Pro that you have, was that a 64 gig or a 32 gig?
It's a 64 gigabyte storage device, two gigs of system RAM.
Yeah, mine is a 32. Boy, I'd never get another 32 gig device again.
Not
ever.
Running Windows, no. No, not running Windows.
Okay. Yeah, I'll tell you, when you mentioned the CloudBook and the sub $200 category between HP and Acer, Dell, all moving towards that.
Yeah.
When you look at the ability to what you can accomplish from a work perspective, I gotta believe, similar to, there were some organizations looking at Chromebooks a while back, but obviously the aversion was, what am I going to really run when you look at so many enterprises and where they are? Yeah. Now that enterprises are starting to migrate, albeit slowly, to Windows 10, you've got to believe that sooner or later some of these enterprises are going to be chomping at the bit for $200 hardware to be able to distribute out to employees.
Yeah. Or even like the Kangaroo PC, right? It's the $100.
Yeah.
With a fingerprint reader.
Yeah, no, it's pretty impressive. I think, again, the problem where Chromebooks have been able to excel in some regards in certain verticals, a lot of enterprise, it's the big problem has been once you start to look past the cost and how wonderful the pricing is, you say, what can I really do in relation to what my enterprise does? Sure. And these $200 devices running Windows 10, I can seriously see gaining some traction there with certain audiences. It's going to be interesting to watch. I think it's all going to come down to Windows 10 enterprise adoption, which is starting to happen now. Yeah. Companies are starting to make the move.
Yeah, my office, I think I may be one of the first ones, but they actually let me upgrade from Windows 8 to 10. And I'm not allowed to do it myself. They had to do it for me. I also can't.
Well, I wouldn't let you. That's why we know you.
Hey, Don. Speaking of work, one of the things you brought up to me was something I really hadn't followed. That's Android for work. What did you? I took a quick look at the webpage for it, which is it's like Google. Is it like the replacement for what was it, Google Apps or whatever, or is that something different?
No, it's a little bit different. So as background, a couple of weeks ago, I went down to New York City for a few days and went to Google's headquarters down there, which were wonderful. Great space, great people. And what they're trying to do with Android for work, when you look at what Windows has traditionally done, Microsoft has done with enterprise level functionality built into the operating systems. This is really what Google's trying to do from an Android perspective. Obviously, in the enterprise, the problem has been for adoption for Android traditionally has been all around security and enterprise level features. And so they're really trying to address it. And so what Android for Work is it's basically functionality baked into the operating system. And essentially, one of the things that Google's done that's pretty nice is it's not specific to just the Nexus devices now. It's any devices running Android 5.1.1 or higher. There's actually baked into the core operating system this functionality to do a few things. You do need to use some sort of device management platform to really manage it properly. It's not something that's configurable without that layer on top. So whether it be Google Apps, for business, which does come with that functionality, or a third-party MDM or a mobile device management or an enterprise mobility management platform. You can actually turn on the functionality and control it. And among the things they're doing is they've done a lot of work around separation of the work and personal data on the devices. They're looking at, everybody talks about BYOD, obviously, is a big thing in the enterprise, but also emerging is what's known as COPE, which is corporate-owned but personally enabled, which is actually becoming quite popular, where I want to give the user a device, I want to let them use it for their personal stuff, but I need to make sure the data doesn't mingle, and I need to make sure that I can protect the business assets, including wiping the business without wiping the personal side. Mm. And they've done a nice job with it. I've been really impressed. And between that and their work with security, there's actually Google does their annual broadcast via Hangout of their state of security with Android. They've actually done a lot of low-level work on it, on making the devices more secure. And to be perfectly honest, anybody who simply blurts out now that Android is fundamentally unsecure, is actually speaking falsely. There's a lot that they've done with the operating system. The key, of course, is to get those devices up to the latest versions of the operating system to make it happen. And that's still a big issue, but with fragmentation. But outside of that, they've come a long way. And obviously, iOS is big in the enterprise, and some of the things around their security have been great. You know, Windows 10, fantastic work, as always has been the case with Microsoft when it comes to the enterprise. But people need to be aware that Android's getting there too. So it's pretty impressive. And I encourage people to look at it in more detail.
And it includes the tablets running Lollipop better, so it's not just the phones.
Yep. Yeah. It's basically Android 5.1.1 and up. Doesn't matter. Yeah, it really doesn't matter what type of device. That includes they also are including it in the Chromebooks as well. Yeah, they're doing the same work there. They're trying to cross all of their platforms to enable this. And they've done a lot of good stuff.
Yeah. And it's a discussion for another time. But, you know, I have a lot of questions about Google's Android tablet strategy because, well, one question is, where is it? But, we haven't seen a good Android tablet. We've seen a lot of good Android phones.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's funny, after working with, and like I said, on a daily basis, I'm immersed in all three operating systems, you know, the big three at this point, or the big two and the one that's trying to get back to being big again in Windows. But Windows 10, when it comes to tablets and stuff, obviously, we're seeing some great work, but it's interesting. Android still reminds me their troubles around having to be, for lack of a better term, it's like going back 10 years and watching it, what Microsoft dealt with when it came to OEMs. A big problem is, how do I get OEMs to really build the kind of hardware to truly support the platform well? Yeah. And unfortunately, it seems like most of your hardware vendors, it's a race to the bottom price point wise. And of course, what's going to happen when I make things inexpensive? It's going to come with sacrifices in terms of capabilities or reliability or things like that. Now, the Nexus tablets themselves, which Google definitely controls, are nice pieces of hardware. They're not terribly expensive, but then again, the OEMs that are building are making, you know, hardware that looks kind of nice and may not be as functional, but maybe a quarter or even less of the price of a Nexus 9. I feel like it's history repeating itself sometimes. All of us lived it 10 plus years ago, watching it with Windows Mobile back in the day, and Pocket PC and smartphone, and it seems like it's happening. It seems like it's a constant battle too on the Android side.
Yeah, I haven't bought a new Android tablet since the Nexus 7, believe it or not, the original Nexus 7. Yeah, I just can't find anything that really appeals to me. That said, you know, the last I did buy an iPad Mini 4 last year. I haven't bought a full size iPad since the iPad 2, which came out in 2011, 5 years ago. But I finally made the big step, and I upgraded to the iPad Pro Junior, as I call it, the 9.7-inch device. So I've got that in hand.
Read that on today.
What's that, Sven?
I read that on your Facebook today.
Yeah. And I have to
How much was that?
Yeah, I said you get you a Kangaroo with that, and you can make a real PC.
You know, that's actually not a bad idea, because I have not bought a Kangaroo PC, and I really would like one. But anyway, to answer Jack's question, I bought the low-end Wi-Fi, so it's a 32-gig storage, $599. And I picked up the smart keyboard cover, which is surprisingly good. I didn't think I'd like it, but maybe it's, you know, after I paid $150 for it, I said, well, I better like this thing. But but it's surprisingly good. I can actually type on it. I use it a lot. You know, it's not Bluetooth, right? It's hardware connected, so it's, you open it up, it's running, which is kind of neat. You don't have to wait for that little lag. And I bought the pencil, which I'm a little disappointed with, but it doesn't quite work the way I thought it would. Hmm. But
the Kangaroo, they have this app pair for the Kangaroo that lets that you be your screen.
Exactly.
So that's interesting.
It is an interesting thing. You know, if I were still a full-time blogger, which I am not, I would definitely, without even thinking, I would get the Kangaroo PC just to put in my travel bag with an iPad. So, you know, I'd have a full-size PC when needed to do, you know, real work, so to speak. But we'll see. I'm really looking forward to playing with this more. You know, jumping from an iPad 2 to an iPad Pro is quite a leap. So even though people say, well, you know, they clock the processor and the iPad Pro Junior. The real name is the 9.7-inch iPad Pro, but that takes too much to say. Compared to the 13-inch or the 12.9-inch. So it does have a slower clock speed. I think it has less internal RAM. I think it only has 2 gigs versus 4 gigs in the big iPad Pro. But you know what? I moved from an iPad 2. It's way faster than what I'm used to. So, and I think a lot of people will like that. You know, the iPad sales have been going down from a market share point of view in terms of how many are sold each year. And I think people just have a longer update cycle. You know, it's not a two-year update cycle like the phones are. I think it's, like me, it's been, 5 years since I updated it. So I'm not going to buy another one till, you know, 2021 or something. But
the phones may be longer now, too, because all the carriers now are not doing two-year contracts anymore.
Yeah, somebody was mentioning that.
Contract comes out, I need to buy a new phone because otherwise I'm just giving them money for nothing.
Yeah. Somebody was just telling me they wanted to buy a new phone because their screen was, you know, not behaving properly and it was out of warranty. And they went to their carrier and says the new iPhone is like, I don't know, $700 or something, $800. So.
Yeah, I know. We now live in a day where we find out the real pricing after everybody went to non-subsidized phones.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting. You know, I bought an iPhone 6 Plus in 2014, and that was the last subsidized phone I'll ever buy, I guess, because my carriers don't have it. I dumped my T-Mobile account last year to go to Google Fi, which actually also uses T-Mobile, you know, in addition to Sprint. But I had to pay full, you know, for the Nexus 6 non-P, the first generation Nexus 6. And it was not quite as bad as buying an iPhone. It was only, so to speak, $500 or whatever. But it was still sticker shock for somebody used to paying $200 for a new phone.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because my wife fairly recently, she finally, you know, she's one of those people. She always has been when it comes to things like technology, you know, where until you see the true value or the true math, it doesn't really register as much. And so she was due for an upgrade for her phone and you know, sticker shock kicked in.
Yeah.
And but I sat down and I said, well, let's look at how this industry has worked and let's work the numbers. And we sat down pencil and paper and I showed how it was a shell game for
by and large. You're absolutely right.
You know, and how it worked. And so when she realized, I said, yeah, now it's just the onus is on you. And depending on the carriers, obviously they're willing to do 0% financing, you know, on these phones. But yeah, suddenly you realize, hey, these things weren't cheap.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
But and as you said, you know, you were paying for the phone monthly in the old days, even when you paid $200 for a new phone. It just didn't realize it.
Yeah. Exactly.
So I'm going to just have to readjust my market thinking, my market psychology when my new phone comes, when the iPhone 7 comes out. And I guess I'll think about replacing the Nexus 6 this year, although because it's getting a little flaky. But at any rate, I wanted to thank Don and Jack and Sven for joining me today on the last minute notice, just so we could have something out fresh in case our Google overlords actually release their podcasting service tomorrow. There will be a new one out. I'll take care of this podcast tonight. And I did want to mention, when John Westfall rejoins me on the podcast, I'm going to talk to him about my recent trip to the United Kingdom and what I experienced with gadgets and things there, including Google Fi, which is, you know, I've never traveled internationally with Google Fi. And so the preview teaser is my roaming charges for Google Fi spending, I was there, I guess, 10 days or 10 and a half days, $3.40.
So. Well, that's it. I'd slam my fist in frustration if I were you, Todd.
Now, can you use that here? I mean, at home?
Oh, yeah. That's my regular phone. That's my regular voice phone. Yeah. So Google Fi is my day-to-day voice phone. When most people call me on my Android phone, my Google Fi service, which is both Sprint and T-Mobile in the U.S. When you go overseas, you're basically using T-Mobile's international roaming plan. And for that, you get data. Now, normally you pay $10 per gigabyte per month in the U.S. And when you're overseas, you don't eat into your U.S. domestic plan, but you also pay $10 per gigabyte per month. And I used, like, you know, I don't know, 300 megabytes or something. So, but I didn't do anything different. I used it as I could. Voice calls are, I think, 10 cents a minute, and I think text messaging is free. So I used it just like I use my phone at home in the U.S., which is great because, you know, I also paid $30, a one-time $30 fee for my AT&T phone, my iPhone, just in case I accidentally turned it on and, you know, it sucked in some email and I wouldn't get charged like $400 for downloading email by accident. But fortunately, that never kicked in, so that $30 went down the drain. But it was insurance, right? It's like insurance.
Yep.
The great thing about that $10 per gigabyte,
yeah.
If you use it, you get it back.
Yes, that's right. That's right, Sven. You're fine. Yeah.
I mean, I think my first Fi bill, because I just use it on a 5X that I use just to play with.
Yeah.
And I don't really take it out of the house very much, so it's always got Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
You know, I get paid like maybe 30 cents for my...
Yeah, you know. I usually pay about $27 a month for my phone, my Google Fi phone, the voice, text, data. So yeah, it's hard to beat. I mean, it is a good price. Okay, anyway, I look forward to talking to John Westfall next time, who is on travel. Again, thanks to Jack and Sven and Don for joining me at the last minute. We will talk to you next time.